The Planchet is a product of the American Numismatic Society. Become a member and support this podcast. Go to numismatics.org/membership. That is numismatics with an S dot O-R-G slash membership to see options and prices.
Striking!
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the very first episode of the Planchet podcast from the American Numismatic Society. I'm Andrew Reinhard. I'm the director of publications, and we thought we'd try something different. So we're going to do a podcast, which is basically, if you haven't listened to one before, it's like a radio show. We expect that this will last about an hour, and we hope to do this once a month to start. And then after things get going, maybe once every couple of weeks, or as interesting things happen in the world of numismatics. I have with me today a special guest, Dr. Jesse Kraft. He's the assistant curator of the Americas at the American Numismatic Society, and he earned his PhD at the University of Delaware in 2019 with a dissertation title of The Circulation of Foreign Coinage, an American Response, circa 1750 to 1857. The topic for today's podcast is Before the Coinage Act of 1857, or basically how Americans spent their foreign money. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Is it planchet or planchette?
I say planchet.
Yeah, it's the good old American pronunciation. It's not the you don't have that extra TTE,
right.
You know, at the end. You know, none of this Francophone stuff. It's the planchet, and you know, you're okay.
This is how I've just been saying it to myself in my head for the past 30 years. You know,
yeah. I think you're right. I'm sure some of the listeners will be pulling their hair out and saying, no, it's the other way. And you know what? I hope to hear from you. And you can write to the Planchet podcast at planchet@numismatics.org. And that's PLANCHET at numismatics.org. And send in your questions, your comments of your thoughts about this first episode of the podcast. But, you know, getting back to the planchet itself, I mean, you're basically looking at, I'll because you're the numismatist here, I'm going to let you define what exactly that is, what it's used for, and where planchets came from.
A planchet is a coin before it becomes a coin, but after it is a blank. So you start out with a sheet of metal, and these are punched out to create small circular pieces of metal without any design on it. At that point, it's a blank. And then it goes through what's known as an upsetting machine, and that kind of adds.
It sounds like a computer. Yeah. Upsetting machine, especially these days.
Yeah, exactly. It is kind of upsetting, isn't it?
Sorry. Please continue.
Then it goes through what's known as an upsetting machine, and this kind of adds a rim to it. And this allows the blank to be struck a little bit better through, you know, pressures of the minting process. But once it goes through the upsetting machine, it's officially a planchet, and then it becomes a coin once it's actually struck with the dies and has the design on it.
So they're
commonly known as type 2 planchets, where type 1 is without the rim, but that's technically a blank. So you have a blank, a planchet, and a coin are the three different phases of a coin's life.
The reason why we decided to call this podcast the planchet as opposed to, say, the blank or the upsetting machine is that, you know, every planchet, you know, you don't know what coin that's going to be. You might, you know, by the diameter, by the metal that's being used, but it doesn't have anything on it yet. And so when you put it through the machine, when it gets struck and it comes out as a coin on the other side, we want to think of each episode of the podcast as being a planchet. No, we want to think of every episode of the podcast as being a planchet. That is, it hasn't been struck yet, but at the end of the episode, you know exactly what it is. And so
there you go.
You know, with this first episode, we now have a planchet about foreign currency being circulated in America's in the United States, or what would become the United States prior to the Coinage Act of 1857. First question is, what exactly is the Coinage Act of 1857?
The Coinage Act of 1857 was the law that ended the circulation of foreign coinage as legal tender in the United States. And prior to this, foreign coinage of many different denominations and from various sorts of countries could circulate legally in the U.S. and merchants had to take them because they were, in fact, legal tender.
So with the foreign currency that we're talking about, you know, we go up to 1857. We know that the Declaration of Independence was 1776. How far back does it go where people could actually legally spend foreign currency for American products?
Well, this went back before the United States even existed. I mean, you know, when there was just colonies, you know, people needed money and they used whatever money was available. Sometimes, or really more often than not, this actually included barter transactions or transactions for services. But when they recorded the money, they still recorded in one money or another. And depending on what kind of currency the other person was used to or dealt with, that, you know, reflected how these individuals had to complete their transaction.
So with the foreign coinage that they're using in these transactions, what kind of currency were they using, or what countries were these coins coming from?
Many different countries. A lot of them were actually coming from what's now Mexico, but it was a part of the Spanish Empire at the time. We used English coinage, Brazilian coinage, which was then a part of the Portuguese Empire, as well as French coinage. Occasionally some German coins came in, but I would say the vast majority of it was Spanish American.
Now, were these like reals or Spanish dollars, or what kind of currency were
they? Yeah, they were mostly silver coinage. So that would be what a lot of people know them as, the pieces of eight or the eight reales, which were divided into eight pieces instead of 100 cents like the dollar was. So these were actually based off of fractions rather than decimals. The British coinage was the old shilling and pence system, which they no longer use now that they use British pounds. The French actually changed regimes kind of during this period. So there are old coinage, which are known as the old regime of France, and they use écus. And then there was post French Revolution coinage, which was in francs. And then the Portuguese used reais, which were mostly gold.
That's a lot to keep straight. I can imagine, like, you know, going into to buy a cow or maybe get a haircut or something, and then, you know, it's like, how much is that? And I don't know, like, if I was the barber, I don't know, like, how to tell somebody that, you know, you go to get your haircut now, what is it, you know, $10, $20. I know in the UK, you can go to barber school and they will charge you £5 and you walk out with whatever they give you. But I can only imagine that these kind of transactions were a little bit different back in the day. So how did the proprietor say how much something was? And then how did the person who's actually buying the goods or the services, you know, how did they pay?
With foreign coins, there were several methods that people used. First, there was exchange charts that people would often reference whenever they came across one foreign coin or another. And this was primarily the way that most people were accustomed to it. But if exchange charts weren't available, there was actually various mathematical arithmetic problems that people could use in order to convert from one currency to another. One of the primary methods was known as reduction, and this was essentially to get one type of money to its core or unit base, the smallest denomination available, and then convert it and then multiply it back into whatever currency that a person wished to, how much their money was worth.
People were doing this on ledgers, or were they doing this in their head? You mentioned just kind of how impossible it is to make change.
Yeah, most people were doing it either in their head or on a piece of scrap paper. As a result, actually finding pieces of scrap paper that do reference these arithmetic conversions are actually quite rare. And I've, throughout the research of my dissertation, I came across only two or three where you can actually see the person computing these exchanges. And it's quite interesting.
We've mentioned dealing with decimals earlier. You know, it's no longer pounds, shillings, and pence. You've got, you know, pounds and cents. You've got, in the United States, you know, you have 100 pennies, you know, equals a dollar, and a quarter is 25 pennies and things. And that just wasn't how it was back then. So, you know, we were talking about things like fractions. What kind of fractions are we dealing with foreign currency? And then was there any kind of standardization with American currency that you could find this kind of equivalence?
Well, there were multiple fractions because there were multiple different types of currencies being used. Like I'd mentioned earlier, the Spanish coinage was based off of 1/8 of the real. English coinage was off of fractions of 1/12 or 1/20. So you had 12 pence to a shilling and then 20 shillings to a pound. So you had to know all these different fractions in order to even begin to compute what your money was worth. Otherwise, you just had really no idea aside from weighing it. But that's, you know, something that, you know, only happened on occasion and only when a coin was suspect of being counterfeit or underweight. But yeah, there were many, many different fractions that you had to know. You basically had to be aware of, you know, how all these different monetary systems worked amongst themselves before you can even begin to convert them into the monetary system that you yourself were accustomed to.
Yeah, I remember you know, coming across this in your dissertation, where, you know, there are a couple of things going on here. You might have, and correct me if I'm wrong, you might have something called a York shilling, which doesn't really exist, but is kind of a mnemonic as far as a unit of measure that people could understand. But the value of this kind of theoretical currency changes depending on where you are in the colonies, for example. So you might be, in some place in New England, and you go to some other place in New England, and it's totally different. And so how did that work, or how did that come about? And then how this kind of get reconciled to try to make things a bit more regular?
Yeah, that actually came about before United States was the United States, back in the colonial times, when each colony began to issue their own paper currency, and all the different types of they still used shillings and pence, all these different colonies, but they kind of linked it directly to the English shilling and pence system. After time, in each of these colonies, as inflation began to kind of take hold of each currency individually and, you know, make them at different rates compared to the English system, once these colonies became states and began to use the actual federal coinage, this inflationary rate kind of took over. So at one point, you know, by the end in Pennsylvania, 1 shilling was worth 13 1/3 cents. And at the same exact time in New York, 1 shilling was worth 12 1/2 cents. And this was just because once the United States began to issue its own currency, it reflected the old values of the British and pence system that kind of evolved in each colony.
You know, when we're talking about evolution of currency, you know, certainly we have evolution of continental currency, colonial currency and whatnot. But I can also imagine that the rest of the world hasn't slowed down with the production of their coinage. And so what happens to an American system or system that's being used in the colonies when these new foreign coins are being introduced and some people are getting them and starting to put them, you know, into transactions in what would become the U.S.?
Yeah, eventually, as the U.S. became more and more attractive to different emigres from different parts of the world, most notably by the 1830s, 1840s, a lot of Germans and Italians began coming across to the United States. They began, you know, they brought their own money with them. And as this occurred, kind of completely threw a wrench into the system that had evolved during the first quarter of the 19th century. And all of a sudden, people were used to the foreign coinage that was in circulation, you know, the Spanish American, the French, and the English. And then all of a sudden, there's German coins that did not compute on the same basis as all the other coinage. And it was coming through New York City in rather large quantities. And for some time, actually, just completely stopped the circulation of hard currency, just because it began to be a part, you know, larger and larger percentage of the monetary supply, and it just, you know, shut it down completely.
I'm assuming that foreign coins that are being used and the other foreign coins that are coming in are, you know, made up of, you know, various alloys, or they might be silver, you know, of a high quality, it might be gold, there might be copper, there might be something else. Were people who are accepting these, were they accepting them on the value of what a particular piece of currency was worth, or are they doing it by the metal value? And I'm guessing that the U.S., when it was trying to stifle all of this foreign competition in currency, might have started buying this stuff up, maybe melting it down or exchanging them for standardized currency. Is that what eventually happened? I know that's a lot of questions in one, but...
Yeah, eventually, that was a part of the Coinage Act of 1857 was for the U.S. government to start buying up foreign gold and silver coinage and kind of just replace them. And they essentially, this actually came in two waves. There's the Coinage Act of 1853, which did this on a partial basis and replaced it with debased silver coinage. Numismatists would know these as the with arrows varieties of the 1853 half dime, dime, quarter, and half dollar. And these replaced largely all the worn out Spanish American phips and levies, which were 6¼ cent and 12½ cent pieces that circulated pretty regularly in the States. And then in 1857, they also tried to replace the rest of them that were still in circulation and did this with the new small cents that also replaced the unpopular large cents. So the 1857 Coinage Act was actually kind of a dual deal that got rid of the old large cent as well as all the foreign gold and silver coinage that circulated at the time.
Was there general acceptance for this, or was there resistance? I mean, were people like hoarding their old coins, or were they happy to turn them in for the new stuff?
I think a lot of people were happy to turn them in for the new stuff for two reasons. One, again, there is a lot of foreign coinage that was being introduced that was unfamiliar to a lot of consumers and merchants in the States. And then also a lot of the Spanish American silver that had circulated was becoming very, very worn and sometimes as much as, you know, weighing 20% less than it should. So this was, directly resulted in a loss of value. So, if something's 20% lighter and you think it's a dollar and it's actually worth 80 cents, that's going to be problematic for the next time you try and use it and somebody rejects it for not being full weight.
We have the coins. They're minted at a certain weight. Then you put them in your pocket. They rub against other coins. They lose the weight and they make it less desirable for people to have. They're like, hey, wait a minute. This doesn't feel like what it's supposed to feel like.
Right.
So that brings me back to one of the things that you mentioned earlier when we started the conversation about counterfeiting. And so if underweight coins, were happening naturally, how were people, counterfeiting, this foreign currency? And what did people do to detect the counterfeits?
Yeah, counterfeiting was a big problem. Today, we're used to, Jefferson nickels and Roosevelt dimes. We know what they look like. There's only, five different coins in circulation. But in the late 18th century, there were so many different coins from so many different countries. You didn't necessarily know the person that was on them. Weights were changing. Compositions were changing. And then, so, there's just so many coins that a counterfeiter could very easily just pick one and begin counterfeiting it. And you would have no idea just because it was one of 30 different coins that you weren't necessarily so familiar with in the way that we are familiar with coins now. So, one of the ways that people frequently tried to detect this was through scales and weights, and people used weight sets that came with individual weights that often represented the actual weight as close as possible to specific coins. So you can buy weight sets that would be the same exact weight as an 8 real and a 4 real and a 2 reales piece, and then use these to check against any coins that you think are counterfeit or underweight.
Were the people who were doing the weighing, were they doing this in front of the people using the counterfeit coins? Like, it's like, wait, stay there, buddy. I'm gonna weigh this on the scale right here. And then, if something was counterfeited, what happened after that?
Yeah, that could very easily happen. Or if sometimes that happens after the transaction at home, I've come across a few account book listings where it seems that people who are given counterfeit gold coinage actually did check them at home and then came back to the merchant. And then the merchant was good enough to give that person a credit for the loss in value from that counterfeit coin. So, it did happen. There are some 17th and 18th century engravings and paintings of people weighing coinage, which looks like they're at a merchant's store front or something along those lines. So, you know, it happened in different places, both publicly and privately.
You know, with the foreign currency that's you know being circulated in the 18th and then you know the early 19th centuries, was there any particular kind of foreign coinage that was more desirable than another? People just like, oh yeah, Spain, give me the Spanish coins, not any of this German stuff, or was it something else? I mean, were they all treated the same, or was one country's currency much more sought after than another's?
Yeah, they were definitely sought after to different degrees. And even the examples that you just used were dead on. I mean, people really wanted Spanish American currency because not only was it known to them, but it was known around the world. And it was, you know, one of the first, or it was actually the first worldwide accepted currency. So, you know, that if you had it, you know, someone, not only would your next door neighbor accept it, but, you know, someone in London or in Amsterdam or even in China would gladly accept it. So where that was not the case with German coinage, really, you know, outside of Germany. And that proved to be the case once large amounts entered New York City and it kind of just shut down gold circulation.
Was there a certain foreign currency that was much more sought after than another's, or were they all pretty much treated equally?
Right. And even with within the Spanish-American context, once these countries began to liberate themselves in the 18-teens, 1820s, the coinage of the newly freed independent countries were less desirable than the old Spanish-American coinage, just because that was thought to be a little more rigidly struck in the sense that, you know, it was the Spanish Empire. They had control of each of these mints. They knew what was happening. They were releasing coinage with all the same compositions. But in the minds of 19th century Americans, when this happened, they had no idea necessarily what was actually the weight or the content of these coins. So the newly struck coins from, you know, say Peru or Bolivia were less desirable than the Spanish American coinage. But today it's kind of interesting. We know that some of these coins actually had greater weights and better compositions than the old Spanish American coinage. It's just that people knew what a Spanish American eight realities was. So that's what they wanted.
There's no substitute for that stuff. Yeah. I remember one Christmas I asked my parents for a bicycle. It's like, you know, give me this kind of bicycle. And they got me a Panasonic bicycle. I'm like, what is this? You know, it's a bike. I can ride it. Right. But it's not really what I wanted, you know. Mm-hmm. Getting back to one other thing that you said with the German coinage, you said that this like crashed the gold market or something in the U.S. Right. Or can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, it really just stifled circulation. And they're piling up in banks throughout the city and in the surrounding areas. And this influx in gold at one point actually made a pretty decent call for the possibilities of having a mint in New York City. This ultimately didn't happen, but it did result in the Independent Treasury Act of 1847, which essentially created a weighing and assay office in New York City. The alternative for people who had large amounts of, you know, say German gold or really any foreign gold and silver that they wanted converted into United States dollars was to send it to the closest mint, which to a lot of the people really at the time was the Philadelphia Mint. There was a few others. There was one in you know, New Orleans. There was one in Georgia, one in the Carolinas. But, you know, for people in New York, if you wanted to convert it, you had to send it down to Philadelphia, you know, on your own dime.
You meant to say that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You have to send it down to New York on, you know, on your own dime. Wait, you know, hopefully no one steals it. Hopefully the Mint employees don't lie or mess up, you know, what they say that the value of your gold or silver coins were, and then, you know, have to wait to have it be struck and sent back to you. So it was a long process that, you know, a lot of people didn't trust, but at the same time, they didn't necessarily know what these gold coins were worth. So they kind of just sat there and really just froze circulation in and around New York City throughout the 1840s and 50s.
All right, so you've got currency that's in gold. You're getting it to the mint. They're melting it down, converting it into something else, and then sending it back to you. Hopefully, the transaction goes well. You're not getting stiffed. You're not getting robbed. And that sounds pretty precarious. And I'm glad that Americans, with their famous ingenuity, they were able to figure out what to do and how to get around this. This leads me to a question. I'm going to say it, the other side of the coin, where, you know, you're talking about early America and you're talking about foreign currency circulating. Was it working in the other direction too? I mean, were people in Europe showing up with large cents, for example, trying to use these to purchase goods and services in some of these other countries who were circulating their currency here in the colonies?
It did not go the other direction. You have the occasional coin, American coin, pop up in Europe, but it seems to be by collectors or something of a novelty piece. You know, as far as like immigration, that was largely coming in this direction throughout this period rather than the other direction. So yeah, you really don't see it. And also after 1817, England had kind of created their own coinage act of 1857, where they banned all foreign coinage as legal tender. So that happened in England much earlier than what happened in the United States. I should add that at one point from the 1790s to about 1815 or 1820, Spanish American coinage actually did form a large percentage of the circulating medium in northern England and even in and around London, Scotland especially. So it did happen to some degree, but not to the degree where it happened to the United States, simply because the mints in Europe existed for, you know, in some cases, 1,000 years by this point, whereas, you know, we were starting fresh in the Americas. So it's a completely different situation.
You've got this well-established coinage coming over from the old country to the new world, and people are using those things and not so much in the other direction, right. Which, you know, makes sense to me. That, I guess, that leads me to the next question, which is, if you have all of this other specie, you know, coming over from various countries in Europe or from elsewhere, what would a typical change purse look like? What would be in somebody's pocketbook just on a day-to-day basis? I mean, you reach in to pay for something and you come out with a handful of what?
Right. You probably have something that's doesn't really resemble what we would even think of as money. Be a handful of metal, that's true. But, you know, you wouldn't be able to recognize the faces. You know, you would have some worn out Spanish American coinage, probably some English shillings. English halfpennies were in great circulation over here that formed a large part of our copper currency before a large cent began circulation. And even the large cent took, probably the better part of two or more decades to really begin circulating outside of Philadelphia. You would have coins that were cut into half or quarters or even eighths, and really just a hodgepodge of bits of metal is what it would appear to the modern person.
I remember, you know, taking a look at some of these coins, these just common coins that are circulating back in the late 1700s. And, you know, there's some that were clipped, or, you know, you think of a quarter dollar today and it's a quarter, it's its own coin. But then you might look at a quarter dollar back then and it is actually a quarter cut from a coin.
Right.
And, you know, how common was that? Anyway, would people, you know, when they reach into their pocket to pay for something, would they also have, you know, pieces like that? And I'm just trying to wrap my head around, you know, these pieces of currency that look like pie shapes,
right.
You know, that are just incidentally that way.
Yeah, absolutely. That formed a large percentage of the hard currency, even in, you know, well-founded places like New York City. And even as late as the 1840s and 1850s, you would have these worn out pie shaped pieces of coin. And sometimes, you know, by this point, by the, you know, the mid 1850s, they would have two different values sometimes in New York City, simply based on whether you can see any of the design or not. And if you, you know, say you had a levy, which was short for 11 penny, which was worth 12.5 cents. Which is, you know, a very confusing system to begin with. But if you had one where you can see the design, then it was worth the full 12.5 cents. If you had one where you couldn't see the design, then it was worth 10 cents. So, you know, these are all things that, you know, you had to know, you know, in order to effectively spend it, or, you know, to not rip yourself off at the same time.
Yeah. I think about, here we are in 2020, and when we're not using cards, you know, or transferring money electronically, what the difficulty would be of the average consumer to, you know, kind of figure in their head, you know, is this going to be 10 cents, 12 and a half cents? I mean, what's a half cent? And then going from there. And I'm just wondering, is this something that you're taught in school? Did your parents teach you outside of school? Was this something that you just kind of picked up? How did you learn how to, you know, do this kind of reduction, do this kind of reckoning?
I think, it was a little bit of both. Those who were fortunate enough to go to school certainly learned it in school. Those who didn't go to school, which was, you know, a fairly large percentage of the population, had to pick it up just through real world transactions and, you know, just, I guess, you know, often a part of apprenticeships and stuff like that. But if you look through, you know, 18th century arithmetic books, you know, oftentimes, you know, a quarter, a third, a half of the book is dedicated to these, what we now would consider complex or, you know, even to the other degree, mundane mathematical problems. It just, you know, just to figure out what our money was worth. And they would talk about these coins, you know, by name. If you, you know, if you had X amount of English shillings or, you know, how many dollars is X amount of Portuguese half joes worth and stuff like that. So it's really, yeah, it's really intriguing.
When you were like doing your PhD comps, I mean, were these questions that you're being asked? They're like, okay, Jesse, do this conversion right now or you fail.
I wish. Okay. No.
Oh, that's a shame. I should go back and do it again.
I agree.
You know, we're spending, you know, this time talking about foreign currency circulating in the pre-United States, basically, you know, up through when it became a nation and up through, you know, the Coinage Act of 1857. And, you know, we're talking about foreign coinage. It's all contemporary stuff. Okay. It's all, you know, things that are being minted now and being used now, you know, now being like 1780. Was there any appetite at that time in, you know, the colonial period where people were collecting foreign coins that were antiquities? And how are these perhaps, you know, treated differently than just your everyday, you know, coins that you're, you know, walking around as, you know, with spending cash?
Yeah, absolutely. People, what few coin collectors there were at the time, they were definitely keeping them as antiquities. And even some of the choicer specimens that exist to this day probably exist through some person who received it and changed and thought that it, you know, still looked nice. So they kept it, whether they considered themselves a coin collector or not, or even had any other coins in any sort of collection. Even, you know, once the Coinage Act of 1857, and even before that, when people were, you know, sending their foreign gold and silver coins to the U.S. Mint to get restruck into U.S. coinage, the assayers at the Mint actually kept the better examples of coins that they kept and actually added them to the Mint collection. So a lot of, and then these eventually went to the Smithsonian. So a lot of the old, you know, Spanish American silver and gold coins that the Smithsonian has actually came into the U.S. Mint, you know, as just a regular piece of gold or silver that Adam Eckfeldt, you know, decided to keep. So
wow, no, that's amazing. Yeah, so yeah. People are sitting in their old stuff, or they're making change. You know, they're at the local store or tavern or something. Like, here are these pieces of eight and this denarius. Hope you like it.
Yeah.
Whoever takes it, it's like, hey, that's cool. That's a Roman coin. I'll just, you know, keep that for myself. Or you know, the Mint is keeping that and sending it over to the Smithsonian. And I had no idea that's how, you know, the genesis of that collection started.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's ancient foreign coins, modern, both not necessarily circulating, but both certainly in play in early U.S. history.
Right. When we were talking about the different state currencies, how you mentioned, you know, there's like the Pennsylvania shilling, the New York shilling, this also had direct numismatic consequences in some of the existing coins of, you know, that we consider now colonial coins to this day. I mean, if you look, at a Higley threepence. I mean, that is a New York threepence that they're talking about. They're not necessarily talking about, you know, the British threepence. Or if you look at the silver groats, the fourpence by Cecil Calvert in Baltimore, I mean, that's they're talking about, you know, the mid-Atlantic states fourpence, or even the famed Massachusetts shillings. By that point, they're talking about Massachusetts shillings and not British shillings or pence. So it's important to remember when you're looking at these coins that these actually do represent particular monetary systems, and sometimes they're the only representations of these monetary systems, and that you really shouldn't consider them any sort of offshoot of, you know, the British system or anything like that, you know, which kind of, in my opinion, you know, adds to their historical significance and interest.
Well, sure. I mean, and, you know, they're also building this strong identity, you know, as this coinage, pine tree shillings or whatnot, are, you know, are becoming popular and becoming known as those things, as being representative of a particular colony. That's got to speak well of what's happening that period in time as we begin as a nation to break away from England.
Right. Oh, yeah. Especially with the Massachusetts. If you look at the timing of it, I mean, it wasn't coincidental that this was during, you know, an interregnum period between, you know, Charles the First and Charles the Second. You know, you have Oliver Cromwell in there. Massachusetts individuals are thinking, hey, we don't have a king right now. We can kind of do whatever we want. Let's make our own money. And that's exactly what they did. So it really is reflective of the times. So they do make interesting pieces.
Yeah, yeah. And those are good looking pieces also, I must
yeah.
say.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, for me, when I'm thinking about the foreign currency being used, I'm always thinking about like the everyday person going and doing everyday transactions. And I'm not thinking about, you know, people in positions of power utilizing foreign currency for other ends and other means. So Thomas Jefferson, he's kind of a big deal. And so, you know, what is he up to with this currency?
Yeah, I mean, the circulation of foreign coinage didn't only affect the people that were actually using it, but it affected the people who kind of had to create the country as it was being created. And Thomas Jefferson, there were several people kind of fighting or vying for the right, quote unquote, to create U.S. currency. And there are some people who wanted to go have it a public institution and create a national mint. There were many people who wanted to have, you know, keep it private and have private enterprises strike a currency. But each of those people or institutions were essentially, you know, trying to, you know, define what is American. And a lot of them actually chose to use foreign coinage to help define what is American. You know, Thomas Jefferson not excluded, and used several of the foreign coinage to actually create, you know, the United States monetary system. Probably the most famous of this is using the Spanish American dollar or reales piece to create the silver dollar, kind of as a one-to-one transfer. But, you know, several of the other coins were based on you know, other circulating coins at the time, to kind of create this balanced system that was able to not only use each of the different coins in the circulation, but then also to kind of align it into this, you know, decimal system that people were kind of unfamiliar with, but eventually became familiar with.
Yeah, the reckoning must have become, you know, just quite a bit easier for everybody. I could imagine the collective sigh of relief once people started figuring this out about how much better it was.
Eventually, it took a better part of a generation for this to happen. Sometimes even longer. If you go into these rural places of you know, New England, people were actually still using the fractions. You know, well into post Civil War. The latest example I found was 1874 up in Massachusetts. People were still reckoning in shillings and pence. Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's always, you know, things are happening in the big cities. You got Philadelphia, you got New York, and things are changing, and people are like on it. They're just, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do it now. And then, yeah, any kind of trend, and this, you know, this happens even today, you know, even, you know, in the digital age, as it were, you know, we get fashion trends or whatnot, and they always kind of start in these hotbed areas and then they trickle out. And so eventually things get to Iowa, you know, right, but yeah, it's like a couple of years. I'm like, oh, okay. And meanwhile, you know, the cities have moved on from that. That's old news. So we have something similar happening in coinage and currency.
I think that's probably also generational too. I mean, if you have these young kids learning this stuff in school in, say, 1810 or 1800, but you have, you know, some old timer who's been doing it for 50 years, that, you know, old timer is going to be doing it for the rest of his life, whereas the young kid is going to, you know, pick up the new system rather quickly and just, you know, automatically gravitate towards that. Yeah, you actually have modern examples of that, like, say, in England in 1971, when they went from the, you know, old British pence and shilling system into the modern pound system. You know, a lot of old people simply didn't get it. And there were, you can go on YouTube today and search for this stuff, but there were, you know, instructional videos that were clearly aimed at the older generation on how to use decimal currency. And it's really, really intriguing. I'm sure it's, you know, the same exact thing that people, you know, in the United States were going through, you know, circa 1800 or so.
Well, for sure. You know, and that also reminds me, forgive me for saying this, Bitcoin. I could just imagine, you know, you like walking into a place and saying, hey, can I pay with a Bitcoin? And like the old timer wants to have something that's going to like put his teeth on, you know, like the old trope about testing for gold or whatever. It's like you got to bite it to make sure it's real. That's the kind of Bitcoin I know. And then you're like, no, generational. Yeah, I'm so sorry. but apologies for the main accent also. It's like a Pepperidge Farm made coins. It's a no Bitcoin cracker for your chowder. All right. Now, when dealing with you know, again, with foreign currency circulating in America, and you've got people in the government, you know, the president or whoever is in charge, colonial governor or whatnot, would decisions that they made about, you know, minting American coins or decisions they made about accepting foreign currency, did that affect mint production in Europe? Were the Spaniards or the Dutch or the Germans, you know, eagerly just kind of, you know, waiting for things to happen so they can mint more coins? Or were they just distressed when the Americans came up with their own system and stopped using foreign coins? Did this affect, you know, the market for the mints elsewhere in the world?
As far as I can see, no. And as far as a lot of these other countries were concerned, you know, this foreign coinage was circulating illegally in the United States. You know, along with the British Act that made foreign coinage illegal in Britain, it also made it illegal to export British coinage. So as far as Brits were concerned, all British coinage was in Britain and all non-British coinage was outside of Britain. So for pieces to actually be circulating in the States, you know, that was illegal to begin with. So it shouldn't have been happening. So it didn't necessarily affect their production output or anything like that. Spanish America, they were, you know, the Spanish were just trying to, you know, extract as much gold or silver as they could from the Americas. So it didn't necessarily impact, you know, how they viewed their monetary output either. They were just had the presses going as quickly as possible.
So when you're talking about Spanish American mints, you know, trying to produce, I mean, how often were these mints running? Were they like 24/7, 365, or did they run them three or four times a week for a few hours a day in order to keep up? And, you know, I think we all know where the gold is coming from, but yeah, with the mint production, you know, for non-American coins that are being used in America, what was the schedule like for them?
I would imagine it to be seasonally, and I know that finding an ample workforce was also problematic for a lot of Latin American mints. So, you know, as long as there was gold in the ground and people there to extract it, they were doing it.
So seasonal coins, the summer coins are the best.
Yes.
You know, you don't want to have spring gold. That's much too green. So let's go for the summer gold. Right. We'll be right back after a word from the ANS.
The Planchet is a product of the American Numismatic Society. The best way to support this podcast is join as a member. Since 1858, we have cultivated a community of scholars, artists, collectors, and amateur enthusiasts interested in numismatics and the tangible history these objects describe. Go to numismatics.org/membership. That is numismatics with an S.org/membership to see options and prices.
So, you know, we're dealing with counterfeit coinage. How are the counterfeiters actually making the counterfeits?
There were several different methods. I mean, one of the obvious methods was to, you know, create a reproduction of a genuine coin, but with lesser intrinsic value. So you have something that looks like a piece of eight, but doesn't have the full, you know, weight or silver content of a piece of eight. This was done in two different methods. You could either have die-struck copies or cast copies. The cast ones were easier to produce, but also easier to detect. Other ways to kind of counterfeit or defraud people with not only foreign coinage, but really any coinage, one way was clipping it. That is to take a round coin or any coin and, you know, clip some extra metal off, but then still spend it as if it had the full weight. Another way was called sweating. And this is actually a really interesting way. One of the ways methods to do this was take a whole bunch of gold coins, you stick them in like a burlap bag, and you shake the bag relentlessly for, you know, quite a bit of time till, you know, you have all the coins banging around and smacking into each other. Then you take the gold coins out. They have lost weight through this process, and then you set the bag on fire, and then you collect all the gold. And then you collect all the gold that's left afterwards. And, you know, you can make, you know, some profit off of this and then still spend the coins as if this process never happened.
Do you think that, like, law enforcement was riding around on horseback listening for the jangling of gold coins in a sack? Like, oh, Tom's at it again. It's like, open up in there. It's like, quick, set the bag on fire. It's like, wow. It's amazing. I mean, Americans will I guess anybody, there's this human ingenuity for cheating.
Yeah, it really is.
That, you know, is like one of the most highly developed parts of the brain. It's, you know, if there's an easy, if there's a way to get around the system, we will find it. That's amazing. All right, so I didn't mean to cut you off. So, like I said, they set the bag on fire after they take the coins out. They collect the gold that sweated off the coins, and
then they have a bunch of free gold. Still and still pass off the coins as if, you know, this process never happened. And another way was to, you know, cut a coin in half, empty out the centers of the precious metal, fill it in with a less precious metal, and then put the coins back together. And this was actually done oftentimes on gold coinage. They would hollow out the coinage and then refill it with platinum. Now, platinum, you know, today is a very expensive metal. Back in the 18th century, it was still expensive, but wasn't as expensive as gold was. But it has a similar atomic weight. So you can extract the gold, gain some value, and then still have a coin that weighed almost exactly the same as the genuine piece.
That sounds like really labor intensive. I mean, you know, when you compare the cost of the labor for doing that against the cost of what you're gaining from creating the counterfeit, I'm guessing that it was to the advantage to do the counterfeiting no matter what the labor was.
Yeah. If it wasn't, people wouldn't do it. So I had to, you know, people had to be making money from this, even though it sounds like, you know, such crazy, you know, it's such a crazy process to us today.
I mean, how did they get the coins back? This is a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You know, how do they get the coins back together? Okay, you've cut the coin, and then you fill it with the platinum or some other weighted metal, and then you've got to put the coin pieces back together and then hide the edge. You know, how do they, like, hide the break?
You would solder it back together and then, you know, kind of file it down. You know, if there was some sort of edge ornament, try to recreate that edge ornament as best as possible. And then oftentimes you would have to gold plate the edge again. So you would kind of have to use some of your earnings, but still it was still worth it in the end.
You think about just trying that today, and nobody's got the patience for that.
Right,
But I guess, gold is gold. So
yeah, few people even have, you know, the tools to cut a coin in half.
No, that's true. I mean, that reminds me, you know, at the ANS, we've got a small collection of box tollers. You know, so you've got a taller coin that's been cut with a saw, basically. jigsaw or something that's been able to split it to a machine-like quality. And on the inside, it's been hollowed out. And, they put in like little artistic things, little hand-painted pictures and whatnot, which is just amazing. And then they've actually been able to create a threaded screw so that you actually screw the taller back together, both halves. Right. And it's really hard to detect the seam at that point. And it's just putting that in mind, as we're talking about this other thing. And for them, it became like a licensed industry of making these box tollers, because they were really popular, because they were cool. You have little miniature stuff in there. So you're making art versus, what you're doing with the gold coinage, which is, you're making something that's counterfeit.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a similar process, for different results.
Other ways of counterfeiting that you can think of that was being done, at that time?
No, those are the primary methods. Ones? Yeah.
And then I guess my last question to follow up on that is, what happened to the counterfeit coins once they'd been identified? I guess back then it works a little bit differently than like counterfeit money once it's discovered happens, now. So you'd said earlier that the person who received a counterfeit coin could return it to the vendor and then, get some kind of credit if the vendor was front and nice about things. But ultimately, what would happen to these counterfeit coins?
A lot of them were returned to the person who originally gave them. What that person did with it is not necessarily known. Some most likely got destroyed. Others, were respent in other places. I guess they lived the life of any outlaw.
Yes. Oh, the outlaw life. who knows? We might be living that again very soon.
Yeah.
For those of you who are listening to this, not for the first time, or maybe the first time, and it's 10 years from now in the year 2030, when people are riding around on motorcycles outfitted with all kinds of weaponry and armor and whatnot, straight out of Mad Max, you'll remember back in 2020, the time of COVID-19 or the coronavirus, which is why Jesse and I are doing this podcast remotely. We're not looking at each other, but we're both in New Jersey, I think, yes. Talking into microphones, having this question and answer. So yes, outlaw life it is. I guess right now it's in-law life because nobody's allowed outside.
Right.
New York is now in lockdown. New Jersey's been under curfew and lockdown now for a couple of days. And the rest of the nation will soon follow. So hopefully this will give everyone something to listen to, something to both enlighten and entertain. Maybe not just once. So we shall see this grand podcasting experiment from the American Numismatic Society. Well, Dr. Kraft, it has been an honor and my distinct pleasure to have this conversation with you today. Thank you for coming on.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, we'll do it again sometime. Maybe in the same room next time around when everyone comes out in the summer and says, the virus is gone. So we shall see.
Yes, fingers crossed.
All right, fingers crossed indeed. And that does it for episode one of the Planchet, not the Planchette, but the Planchet podcast from the ANS. I'm Andrew Reinhard, Director of Publications, and we'll talk to you next time.
Striking!